main fault I find with this argument is premise one, that everything that begins to exist has a cause.
It's a pretty well-established fact that the universe began at a finite point in the past. What caused God?
And then they take this kind of flying leap to assume that this cause is God.
Of late, philosophers have really started to seriously question the notion of causation.
Welcome to Reasonable Faith. Conversations with William Lane Craig. I'm Kevin Harris, and we hope you'll find the topics we discuss enriching and enlightening concerning the big questions of life. Dr. William Lane Craig is a noted philosopher and theologian known for his work on the existence of God, philosophy of time, and the resurrection of Jesus. And we invite you to discover the wealth of resources at reasonablefaith.org. There you'll find Dr. Craig's famous debates with leading atheists, articles, books, podcasts, audio from Dr. Craig's Defenders class, and a question and answer section featuring amazing questions people send us and answers from Dr. Craig. That's reasonablefaith.org. reasonablefaith.org. Well, Dr. Craig, I don't think a day goes by that the Kalam cosmological argument doesn't come up somewhere on the internet or in conversations at Starbucks. You've made quite a splash with your development of this argument, and we've got a question about it from someone who's read your material that we want to address here in just a moment. I'm wondering if you've ever heard this objection. But before that, it's interesting how when your book on the Kalam cosmological argument first came out in what, 1979?
Right, 79 was when it appeared.
It didn't exactly tear up the bestsellers list.
No, as David Hume said, it fell stillborn from the presses. It went almost immediately out of print. It was an utter failure in terms of a literary product. And so Macmillan, seeing that it wasn't selling, just immediately sold off all the remaining copies for $2 a piece, and the book went out of print.
But what happened was somebody got a hold of it because it began to be examined and grappled with, and it led to some other works of yours. But Quentin Smith made an interesting comment.
Well, yes, in the Cambridge Companion for Atheism that came out this past year, Smith says that the Kalam cosmological argument has become the most discussed argument for the existence of God among philosophers today. And he said, whether they like it or hate it, philosophers cannot leave the Kalam cosmological argument alone, which suggests that it's got something going for it, or it at least raises some deep questions about the nature of the universe. So it's been gratifying to see after its very halting start that this argument has had some impact.
Now, you've written on it in other works, including the third edition of Reasonable Faith, and I think also in the Cosmological Argument book that you wrote. But aren't people now, since that seed has been planted and there's more interest than ever, people are going to go back and read that initial work?
Well, that's the hope. Wipfenstock has republished the original Kalam Cosmological Argument so that it is back in print today, not with the original publisher, but with this reprint company. And it does continue to sell every year. It sells a few score copies. So that's gratifying.
I'm curious if there has been very many revisions. When you look back to 1979, has it held up to where you haven't really had to go back and revise anything or reword anything?
There's been very little, Kevin, about the original book that I would retract. There have been a couple of things where I would retract it and formulate the argument differently. For example, the Tristram Shandy paradox about the man who writes his autobiography so slowly that it takes him an entire year to record the events of a single day. And I think that in my subsequent work, I've rephrased this paragraph in a way to avoid an obvious objection that the original formulation was open to. But basically, the work that I've continued to do on the argument has been a matter of updating it in terms of more recent discoveries in cosmology and astrophysics, and also of augmenting the argument by surfacing the theory of time that the argument presupposes, and then providing a very robust defense of that view of time. And I'm talking here about a view of time that sees time as dynamic, that temporal becoming is real. Things really do come into and go out of being, that there is a difference between the past, the present, and the future. Ontologically speaking, the past is real. The future is not yet real. And I think it's been that defense of this view of time that has also helped to strengthen the original argument. In the original book, I was aware of this underlying view of time, but I did not know how controversial it was. And so it's been very, very interesting for me. And I've learned a lot through exploring the nature of time and being able to shore up the argument by giving a defense of that underlying presupposition.
What do philosophers call that theory of time that you embrace?
Well, it's variously called the A theory of time, after John McTaggart, who was a Scottish philosopher in the early 20th century, who distinguished between these two views of time. And he just called them the A theory and the B theory. And those labels seem to have stuck. Now, those labels aren't very descriptive, unfortunately, A and B. So sometimes the theories are called the tensed theory of time versus the tenseless theory of time. Or other times it's called the dynamic view of time versus the static view of time. So all of those would be different nomenclatures that are used to characterize these two contrasting views of time.
For people who want to explore that further, what book of yours would you recommend?
Well, if the listener is a lay person who's not a professional philosopher, I would highly recommend my book, Time and Eternity, published by Crossway. This has a thorough examination of the pros and cons for these different views of time, and then discusses how that will impact your view of God's relationship to time. I'm convinced that your view of divine eternity stands or falls upon the view of time that you adopt. And so this is all explained in layman's language very clearly in the book Time and Eternity. For more advanced readers, I published a pair of books, one called The Tensed Theory of Time, A Critical Examination, and the other, The Tenseless Theory of Time, A Critical Examination. And both of those are available through Springer Verlag, which is a German publisher, though the books are in English.
You know, Dr. Craig, a few years ago, you were really studying philosophy of mathematics for a while. Did that shed any light or anything on your Kalam cosmological?
Oh, it does, and I'm still working on that. That is my major research project right now. This, again, would be a further advancement or deepening of the Kalam cosmological argument, because in the argument I claim that an actually infinite number of things cannot exist. And many mathematicians and philosophers think that there are an actually infinite number of abstract objects, numbers, for example, or sets, or propositions, or other sorts of mathematical entities. And so I have been exploring the metaphysical or ontological status of abstract entities to see whether or not these things really exist. Because if they don't exist, then they're not a counterexample to the claim that an actually infinite number of things cannot exist. And so I'm working on developing what's called a nominalistic view of abstract objects like numbers and sets and so forth, according to which these things don't actually exist.
If you had an infinite number of monkeys and an infinite number of typewriters, would one of them eventually write a sonnet from Shakespeare?
Well, if they're typing randomly, they would. That's right. In fact, it would be typed an infinite number of times.
Well, see, that's it. Not only would they type it once, but perhaps an infinite number of times.
Right. If it's random, if that's the way the monkeys are working, then that is one of the possible arrangements of all these letters. And so in infinity, it would occur.
It was a compelling objection to that I heard one time, and that is that an eternity doesn't necessarily contain everything. It may be that that monkey would type randomly for an infinity and never type a sonnet.
Right.
You know, I mean, does an eternity contain everything?
No. Well, I think what we were thinking of there would be where the monkey would have a limited amount of letters to type. Say he would type 365,000 letters, and that would count as one work. And then he would type 365,000 again, and that would count as another work, and then 365,000 again. And eventually, this would produce Hamlet, because that is one possible arrangement of all of these letters. But, I mean, clearly you're right. In one sense, if you don't divide it up, the monkey could just type letters forever, and it wouldn't produce any single work because it would just be an infinite sequence of letters, and there's an infinite number of different infinite sequences of letters. But if we think of it as divided up into separate works, eventually this would occur somewhere.
That's fascinating. Let's get to this objection. Gypsy Scholar was a person who was interacting with your work here, and it looks like his objection is, if there really is a state that can only be described as the absence of absolutely anything, I mean, nothingness, well, then there's not even a principle. There are no principles. And if there are no principles, then there's no principle of causality. Therefore, something could pop into existence uncaused because there's no principle to say otherwise. Do you see where he's going?
I think I understand what he's saying, but I think that it's misconceived. I think it's not correct. He seems to think that it is the principle of causality that constrains things somehow, that it is the principle that is responsible for whether or not things can come into being uncaused from nothing or not. And that's simply false. The principle, if it even exists at all, and this is what we've just been talking about, would be an abstract object. A principle isn't just, say, a sequence of letters on a piece of paper or sound waves produced in the air by someone uttering it. The principle, if it exists at all, would be some sort of an abstract entity, like a proposition. But abstract entities, by definition, by their very nature, don't causally impact anything. The number 7, for example, is causally effete. It has no causal effects. It has no impact upon anything. So the principle of causality, if it exists, is utterly impotent causally. It doesn't do anything. It would just simply express a truth. It is true that whatever begins to exist has a cause. And it seems to me that that is true, and that, therefore, whether we're talking about the universe existing or we're talking about nothing existing, it is the case that something cannot come out of nothing, that whatever begins to exist has a cause. And the reality of the principle has simply nothing to do with that. My own inclination is to think that the principle doesn't exist at all, that there isn't any such thing as the principle. Rather, it's simply true that whatever begins to exist has a cause, or to make it even simpler, just whatever begins to exist has a cause. And to reify this into some kind of a thing, a principle, I think is just quite wrong-headed and, in any case, irrelevant to the truth of the premise.
May I say that I think people are being really stubborn about this first premise? You didn't expect people to attack the first premise. You thought the second premise of the Kalam,
yes,
that the universe began to exist.
That's clearly the controversial premise. And I think it's testimony, frankly, Kevin, to the strength of the argument. The first premise, I think, is virtually undeniable for any sincere and sane person.
There are a few stubborn holdouts, it seems.
Well,
maybe
exactly.
They're getting smaller.
I don't know. I think that the fact that atheists, in order to deny the argument, are driven to deny this almost self-evident first premise that whatever begins to exist has a cause is simply testimony to the force of the argument. Because apart from that, I don't think anyone would be driven to deny the truth of the causal premise. When you think about it, to deny the causal premise is worse than magic. To say that things just pop into existence uncaused out of nothing is really worse than magic. In magic, at least you've got the magician who pulls the rabbit out of the hat. But in this case, the rabbit or the universe is supposed to pop into being out of absolute non-being, which to me is simply intellectually irrational to believe.
When you said that abstract objects don't cause anything, the number 7 doesn't cause anything, a principle doesn't cause anything as an abstract object. You tie that in your work with why God is a personal God.
Yes. One of the main challenges with the cosmological argument is to show that the ultimate cause of the universe is a personal being. Otherwise, you just have some sort of impersonal cause of the universe. And I think we have a very compelling argument for the personhood of the first cause. And it would go like this. The cause of the universe as the cause of space and time must be beyond space and time, and therefore must be an immaterial, timeless being. Now, there are only two kinds of things that fit that description of being a timeless and immaterial being, either an abstract object like a number or else an unembodied mind or consciousness. But an abstract object cannot stand in causal relations because they're causally effete. They don't have any causal impact upon anything, so they cannot be the cause of the origin of the universe. And therefore, it follows logically that the cause of the universe must be an unembodied personal mind.
Would the maneuver of perhaps the atheist philosopher at that point try to dispel then that minds can be unembodied, where they say that dualism is false and that your mind is your brain?
This is the response that I have been getting lately from atheists, and it rather surprised me, but it made me realize how deep-seated is the skepticism about the reality of mind today. Some people simply do not believe that there can be an immaterial self or mind or soul. And it is because they adopt a materialistic or physicalistic view, I think, of human persons. They think that we are just electrochemical machines, bags of chemicals on bones, and that there is no immaterial self or soul to us. And therefore, they can't believe that God could be an unembodied mind either. They simply can't make sense of this. And of course, this isn't just a refutation of the cosmological argument. As I point out to these atheists, if you're not willing to be open to the idea of an immaterial mind, then you can't even get started on theism. You can't even entertain the possibility that God exists if you don't think it's possible for there to be a mind that's distinct from the physical body. So this is a very deep, deep underlying issue about what persons are and whether minds can exist. And if the Kalam cosmological argument is sound, it gives us, I think, a good reason to believe that there can be minds that are distinct from physical substrata, that there can be an immaterial self who in this case is the creator of the world. And then it's up to the atheist now to give us some argument as to why it's impossible for there to be minds. He needs to give some argument for mind-body identity or reductionism or materialism and to show us why it's impossible for there to be minds. But that is definitely the route that many atheists would go at this point.
I think I'm just now starting to see this, Bill, that this actually is an argument for disembodied mind or for dualism, rather than attack that notion that there can be a disembodied mind. They're missing the point that this could be an argument.
I think
because if the only two choices are an abstract object or a disembodied mind, because that's the only things we know of, and it can't be an abstract object, we've got a case here for mind as separate from body.
I think that's right. And it's a non-circular case. It begins from premises having to do with the origin of the universe and the existence of a finite past. And it issues finally in the conclusion that there is an immaterial personal creator. So it is an argument, I think, for the idea of mind. And it means then that the atheist will have to give us some sort of an argument against the possibility of mind. He can't just simply say, well, I don't believe in minds. We've just given an argument for a mind, and he needs to then show us why this is impossible.
I think this brings up how important this whole philosophy of mind is to the Christian faith. Many writers think that advances in neuroscience and study of the brain are actually going to be the death knell of Christianity by showing that there is no soul or that there can't be a disembodied mind. And I actually saw a response to your Christianity Today article that said, "This is an awesome article, and let me encourage everyone, if you want to be an apologist for the future, study the mind-body problem." I thought that was pretty good.
That may well be prescient, because I do think that philosophy of mind is intimately connected with belief in God. Because if you are a theist, you have to believe in the existence of an unembodied mind, which is independent of the material universe. And if that idea is incoherent, as materialists and physicalists claim, then you simply cannot be a theist. So this area of philosophy of mind is critical to Christian apologetics.
Thank you, Dr. Craig, for spending some time with us. And thank you, the listener, for being here today. This podcast is available at reasonablefaith.org, as well as a wealth of audio, video, and written materials from William Lane Craig. People all over the world have benefited from the insights of Dr. Craig, and we invite you to browse our resources at reasonablefaith.org. And when you give to Reasonable Faith or purchase our resources, you help us expand into more media and speaking events, taking Christ to a world of big questions. So be sure and visit us at reasonablefaith.org. I'm Kevin Harris. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you next time on Reasonable Faith with William Lane Craig.